Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, still at the Conservative Party conference in Manchester. It's been a long time. There was lots of talk last week about Andy Burnham being the selfie king of the Labour Party conference. There's only one person who's the selfie king this time.
Did you have a good conference?
Good, I'm glad.
Take care. Wait, Rishi, do you get fed up with doing all your selfies?
No, gosh, it's great, actually.
You're like a rock star.
It is just...
You're more popular than Andy Burnham was last week.
Right, we haven't been able to do this for
that is true. Same people. Well, I'll let you go. It's your very much
nice,
tomorrow.
Nice to be able to see everyone. Say thank you for all their support.
Absolutely, good to see you. And I actually stopped at some of the people asking Rishi Sunak for a selfie to ask them why.
Hope you guys have a good time.
Hi guys, I'm from Times Radio.
Yeah.
Why do you love Rishi Sunak so much?
He's amazing, isn't he? It's Rishi, isn't it? He can't beat him.
Why is he amazing?
I think he's next Prime Minister material. He seems to have everything we need and very competent when talking, and he's very reassuring to
He's like a rock star. Look at all these people having their photos taken with him.
Great. Next Boris Johnson, I should say.
The next Boris
next
Johnson.
Boris Johnson, quote that as well.
I think. How old are you all?
17.
What are you all doing here? Why are you with the Conservative Party? Why aren't you like...
Ready to twist. We're all... me, Daniel and Thomas are from Liverpool.
Right.
So...
Young
Tories from Liverpool. That sounds like hard work. Liverpool.
And, you know, Rishi Sunak down there, he speaks... in such confidence in times of such economic hardship, and I think it gives the British public hope. I mean, sitting there listening to him, he was outstanding, and he made me feel proud of the party.
So that's who you really like. Which member of the cabinet don't you like?
I don't think we're allowed to comment on that one.
Yeah.
God, you're so well trained as well. Anyway, thank you very much. Good to meet you. Cheers, guys. Right, enough of that nonsense. Coming up on today's episode of the podcast, really interesting chat with Nick Timothy. You'll remember he was a special advisor to Theresa May at the Home Office for 6 years, longest serving Home Secretary in modern history. Big day, of course, today. Priti Patel was giving her speech at the Conservative Party conference. We've got Nick Timothy on, also to talk about levelling up and that election, because obviously he followed Theresa May into Downing Street in 2016, but then left a year later after that election went so badly wrong. So you have a really probably interesting chat with Nick Timothy coming up. But first, our columnist panel, and joining us today in Manchester was the Financial Times' Seb Payne and Kate Andrews from The Spectator. You were both just discussing how much you enjoyed not having WhatsApp.
Yes, yes. Oh. This conference was so weird. From about 5 o'clock yesterday, the whole thing ground to a halt as WhatsApp disappeared. And I think I felt more bereft than at any time over the past 18 months. I just had no idea what to do. You know, how do you communicate with colleagues, friends, family? And I had to do an unthinkable thing. I had to go and find a physical Tory party press officer and ask them a question in person.
Why didn't you just send them a text?
See, that's the kind of thinking that didn't occur to me at the time when I was in the stages of a nervous breakdown and not being able to WhatsApp anyone.
Yeah, it's the kind of innovative thinking you need in a crisis. And unfortunately for Seb, you weren't around.
And it just goes to show how much politics relies on WhatsApp.
It is, and what I realised, I was trying to knit together a story for that evening's FT, and I was going through my contact, MPs, special advisors, ministers, and I just realised everything is there. And it also made me this horrific feeling. I thought, wait a minute, what if this is a massive hack and everyone's WhatsApps are going to go into the public domain?
That was a, wow, that's a terrible
exactly. And I sort
he's
of,
still shaking.
Exactly, I'm not recovered yet. And I was just thinking, imagine all the stuff everyone's ever said on WhatsApp and if all that just went into the public domain. It would be the end of society, really.
Yeah, well, it turns out I think they just unplugged something and now they've plugged it back in. So all is well with the world again. Yeah, I just ignored the WhatsApp outage and went to bed. It was lovely.
That sounds
I'm
like
incredibly smug today. as I am every day.
You're looking much prettier than we are. So
that's let's not get bogged down. Right, I suppose we should talk about politics. And let's start with Brexit. It was really interesting. We've got an interview coming up with Andy Street in about an hour's time. And I pressed him on this, you know, he basically said, well, you know, if wages are going to go up, then prices are going to go up. And he said, that's just the price that we have to pay. That's the price of Brexit. Is he right, Kate?
Well, I would dispute that this is all about Brexit to begin with. So the new immigration policy was always going to be painful for some businesses. They were complaining about it in January 2020. And the Prime Minister's response at the time, similar to now, is, well, you're just going to have to hike your wages for native workers here at home. What we weren't expecting was a global pandemic that saw roughly 1 million people leave the country essentially overnight. And so we knew that there was going to be some tightening in the labor market. We did not realize it was going to be plus 1 million people gone on top of that. So I think it's a mistake to say this is just about Brexit. The trade-off for the labor shortage that we're experiencing now, and there's some real pain around that, is that wages on average are skyrocketing. And they're skyrocketing for people who I think were very much taken advantage of or overlooked for a decade leading up to this point. You know, they used to be called low-skilled. Now they're called key workers after the pandemic. So, you know, there are real winners and losers from this, and we have to acknowledge both sides of it. I think it's really silly to pretend that there's no pain associated with this. Customer prices are going to go up, but we also have to recognize that people who were overlooked for wage increases had stagnant wages for a decade are also going to be the winners in this situation. And it's hard to fault that in some ways.
Well, I suppose the where Brexit kicks in, Seb, is that had Brexit not happened, some of these labour shortages wouldn't be happening because people could come in from elsewhere in the EU.
I think that's certainly true, Matt. And the way that Boris Johnson and his government are leaning into this is really quite fascinating because they've talked about, you know, ending the economic model we had before. They described it as the EU's economic model. I'm not quite sure how it's linked to the EU, but never mind. And the idea is that they are actively trying to push wages higher. What I'm concerned about is, and if we go back to the lessons of the 1970 when inflation was rampant, are you going to get the productivity gains that go with that? Because if not, then you just get inflation. But clearly, the Tories think the message coming out of this conference that we are increasing wages is one that goes down quite well with the general public, which it certainly does. But the transition, I think you're alluding to this, Kate, to get to that point is going to be very bumpy. And I do actually wonder if ministers are prepared for this to go on for months, if not longer. You know, Rishi Sunak's talked about the disruption in Hawley is going on till Christmas. But, you know, readjusting a labour market after a certain model that's lasted for several decades, that's not going to be quick and it's not going to be simple. And at the moment, Boris Johnson, if you've seen from his morning interviews, he's riding high. He thinks this is his party. He's in an imperial mode, shall we say. But I do wonder if he'll be able to hold his nerve to that point. But they seem confident they will get there.
Do you think, in part, the reason I focus so much on we're putting up wages, Kate, is to slightly gloss over the fact they're also putting up taxes?
Absolutely. And this is one of the biggest risks to this Tory government is a looming cost of living crisis. I don't think the question is whether or not it happens. It's how bad it is, because you have this perfect storm of inflation is going up, even if it doesn't spiral out of control. And goodness, let's hope it doesn't. The Bank of England now thinks inflation is going up to be above 4% by the end of the year. Electricity bills are going up this winter. The gas shortage is real. The tax hikes haven't come in yet, but they're going to come in and people are going to feel it. Prices are going up. And so, yeah, again, they're trying to point out where the data increasing is actually a good thing. But I think this could become quite painful. And, you know, if your wages are going up, great. But if prices are also going up and you don't feel like you're better off, you know, even if you don't know exactly why that is, you're going to look to the Tory government and think, well, your selling point is that I'm always supposed to be a bit better off. That's the reason we elect people like you. And if it isn't the case, then you're going to be frustrated. The last thing I would say, though, on this Brexit point is let's not forget that Brexit isn't the reason that people left. The reason people left the country was because of COVID. Mm. And even if we hadn't left the European Union, it strikes me that many, many people, you know, hundreds of thousands would have still gone home to where they felt safer. And a lot of these shortages aren't just being felt in the UK. They're being felt Europe-wide. There's a reason. I think it's something like a handful of lorry drivers have actually used the scheme now, the visa scheme, to come to the UK.
It's like 30 or 40-something out of 5,000 visas.
Exactly. That's because the labour market has fundamentally changed. These people have moved into different kinds of roles. It's an issue in the EU as well as it is in the UK.
And what about Rishi Sunak more broadly? He was sort of defending those tax rises yesterday, Seb, saying that they're not unconservative, that reckless borrowing and spending, that's unconservative, and trying to argue that putting up national insurance to pay for the NHS and social care was the conservative thing to do. Do you think he persuaded the hall?
To a certain extent, and I think the historical echo they want to get there is what Margaret Thatcher did in her early budgets when, again, public spending and inflation were issues and she raised taxes to then eventually cut them much later in her premiership. And I'm sure that's exactly one Rishi Sunak would want to do. But I went to a fringe event yesterday where Steve Baker was there, the Libertarian Conservative MP, and he said to the whole room, we're all socialists now. And they all laughed. And he just sort of did his own, you know, freedom cry, smaller state, lower taxes. That's still where the heart of the Conservative Party is, and you're going to get much more applause, much more plaudits for that kind of language than what Rishi Sunak was saying. But I guess the calculation that Sunak and Johnson have made is the wider public, they don't think about tax in the way that people like Kate and I do. You know, they just look at their lives, they look at the cost of living. And I do think it'll be interesting to know when that is going to hit, because the opinion polls are kind of extraordinary when you think of the disruption outside with the lorry drivers, with turkeys, with pumpkins, you name it. We're in this conference hall and everyone's very upbeat, they're happy. It's like we're in an alternative reality in some ways.
But I suppose there is an interesting question, though, isn't there? The Steve Bakers of this world, who would like low taxes and, you know, low borrowing and all that as well, would they have been happy to have ridden out the last 18 months if Rishi Sunak hadn't spent all that money? You know, you can't have it both ways. Part of the reason why the Conservative Party are in the strong position they are is because they've spent so much money in the last 18 months shoring up, whether it's furlough or business grants or whatever else. And it's sort of quite easy to go to a fringe event, Kate, and get a round of applause for saying, oh, we should have lower taxes. But while part of the reason why there's such a good atmosphere is because Rishi Sunak spent such a phenomenal amount of money.
Yeah, and protected so many jobs. Unemployment was supposed to peak at over 12%, and it's below 5%. And I don't think you cannot credit the furlough scheme, but it was extremely expensive. I think close to £70 billion it's going to come to. I think there's a lot of truth to that. I think Rishi Sunak is being more honest with the grassroots than a lot of other members of the party.
That's interesting.
He's saying, look, fiscal responsibility and tax cuts are both conservative principles, but the moment we can't afford both, so I've decided to go for fiscal responsibility. And actually, people like me have a lot of sympathy for that, because he's looking at inflation, he's looking at the possibility of rising interest rates, and he wants to make sure that the government can continue to pay its bills. It's not a sexy topic, it's not easily persuadable, but I think the Chancellor's doing a pretty good job of making the case. The difficulty, though, and where Rishi and Thatcher are different, is that the Thatcher government was very clear that tax cuts were the end goal. that we were going to get to tax cuts after taxes were raised. And this government, Rishi said he wants tax cuts, but we don't know at all when they might be coming in. And I struggle to see a scenario where they are cut in the near future. If anything, I fear they're going to rise again because the NHS isn't going to want to give the money over to social care that it's supposed to do in a few years' time, coming from this new national insurance hike. So I fear that the conversation is in the wrong place, and maybe that's where the party's getting it so wrong. I've heard so many ministers at these drinks receptions and fringe events say, you know, we're the party of low tax. No, you're not. You're not right now. And you know, at least Rishi's being honest about that, and he's making the case. But I think the conversation for the Tories is still in the wrong place.
And I see what the language, Kate, is actually really interesting. They're now not actually saying we are the party of low tax, we are the party of lower tax. And it's a classic thing that they do. So they can say Labour wants high taxes, we want lower taxes.
But we don't even know if that's true, because Labour oppose the national insurance. I mean, it's an incredible thing that the Labour Party are opposing national insurance rise in the NHS.
Yeah.
But they are. So based on what we know right now on Labour tax plans.
And they want to scrap business rates.
Yes.
And that hasn't been, you know, the shadow chancellor laid down the gauntlet and Rishi Sunak did not pick it up.
And actually the Labour Party conference last week, you know, the British Chambers of Commerce, the CBI, they were lapping all that up.
No, of course they were.
And this just shows this sort of alternative reality we're in, where I just think people, A, aren't thinking about politics that much. They're just delighted we're not in lockdown. And
who
I think
blame them?
Exactly. But I think there will be a point when this cost of living stuff does kick in. And I think obviously this week you've got the universal credit uplift is going to end. The furlough scheme has ended. And that will have an economic impact. And you have to think at some point, you know, not every response will just be Conservatives plus 10 points to every single thing that goes wrong in the country.
Yeah, it's one of those things where, you know, people keep complaining to me about saying, you know, I always note, well, the Tories are still 4, 5, 6, 7 points ahead of the polls, despite all of the obvious areas of criticism. One other thing I just wanted to touch on, Seb, like I'm sort of speaking to Andy Street later on. You've been taking a look at one of, as part of trying to flesh out what on earth levelling up is, Michael Gove suggesting more local mayors. We've obviously got Andy Street in West Midlands, Andy Burnham here in Greater Manchester. What other areas could get them, do you think?
So I think the Department for Levelling Up, as it's called, or as someone told me, apparently it's got the nickname Deluxe in Whitehall, which is...
Deluxe?
Because if you took the acronyms, apparently that just about works. So we're deluxing the country or deluxing or whatever metaphor you want. Sorry, I won't go any further. but I think fundamentally, you've got North Yorkshire, apparently they're talking to. You've got Cumbria, they're also talking to. But I think one interesting thing that Michael Gove is looking at is county deals. Because if you look at the west of England, for example, where would you create a conurbation to have a mayor like Greater Manchester there? So they clearly want to do more of those. And what's interesting about how Mr. Gove's describing levelling up is we all just think of it as pork barreling, just throwing money at places to make them vote Tory. He wants them to be able to attract much more money coming inwards, and part of that may be having different tax raising powers. And I asked him in an event I did at the conference yesterday, could you devolve income tax or corporation tax or business rates? And he said, not yet. So I think that is a very interesting one to watch. Now, obviously, the logistics of doing that are horrifically complicated, but it does show things the government are doing to look at this in a different way. So it's not just about piling money in, as we report in the FT this morning. The big white paper on levelling up is coming out on October the 27th. So by the end of the month, we should actually have some kind of policy so we can say exactly what levelling up is about.
Kate Andrews and Seb Payne there. Right, coming up next is my chat with Nick Timothy.
1-800-Flowers.com is more than your birthday, anniversary, or just because gift-giving destination. We put our hearts into everything we do to help you celebrate all life's special occasions with friends and family. From our farmers and bakers, florists and makers, everything from 1-800-Flowers is made with love every step of the way, because we know that nothing is more important than delivering a smile. To learn more, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.,
Oh, no.
So how would that go in the booth?
Badly. Go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
You're listening to the Red Box podcast. Now it's time for my interview with Nick Timothy. We're talking a bit about what's, you know, the nuts and bolts of policy and all that sort of thing. But explain what it is really like in the Home Office. Because particularly during the Labour years, Tony Blair had a new Home Secretary sort of once a year for various reasons. They had to resign, whether they lost files, or they lost prisoners or whatever it might be. What is it like in the Home Office as an institution? And when you arrived with Theresa May in 2010, try to get your head around all of that. Because ultimately, if something goes wrong, the buck's got to stop with you and, and the Home Secretary.
Well, I guess the first thing to say is I went into the Home Office in 2010 with a full head of hair, and I left in 2015 completely bald, which says quite a lot about what it's like to work there. I think it was Jack Straw, who was one of Tony Blair's Home Secretaries, who said, the problem with the Home Office is at any one time there will be several dozen officials working in the department on something that will end your career. And the problem is you don't know who they are and they don't know who they are either. And it is a little bit like that. And I think the reason it's like that is because obviously there's huge sensitivity about the things that the department is responsible for, whether that's crime and policing, or the immigration system, visas, etc., or, you know, the most serious end, counter-terrorism. And you're responsible for setting the policy, in some cases holding the organisations that do the operational delivery to account. But there's, you know, there's hundreds of thousands of decisions every year in terms of issuing visas, letting people cross across the border and that kind of thing. And you end up politically responsible and, you know, potentially on the firing line. If there's a mistake on the front line.
So how is it? What was the trick? How did Theresa May survive in that job in a way that so many of her predecessors didn't?
Pure control freakery, I think. which may not have served us so well in Number 10, but did serve us well in the Home Office. I mean, you've just got to maintain a really tight grip. You've got to know everything that's going on. Any policy paper you know, has to come up via the special advisors, via the private office, via the junior ministers. So there are, you know, layers of checks to make sure you're not accidentally signing your own death warrant. And making sure that that the institutions, you know, the organisations that deliver the stuff at the sharp end are working, and the people who are running them are accountable. And that, I think, is one of the hardest bits.
It's interesting you said that, contrasting with what worked at the Home Office working less well in... are some people more suited to being effective cabinet ministers than prime ministers, do you think? In the end, what was very successful at the Home Office for Theresa just didn't... You just can't be like that if you become prime minister.
Yeah, I think that happens. I mean, I think...
I mean, Gordon Brown was
a classic example. I think, you know, in a department, you've got to be across everything. In Number 10... you can't be in the weeds of policy in the same way. I think I've written before that basically in Number 10, it's your job to sort of write the score and conduct the orchestra, but not play the instruments. And I think for some politicians, that's quite difficult to do, especially if you've like been in the Home Office for six years, or in Brown's case, been in the Treasury for such a long time. And, you know, the opposite is true. But, you know, Boris is a sort of big picture, sort of primary colours kind of prime minister. To be honest, I can't imagine him being the work and pensions secretary.
Yes. Making sure that money is being processed on, you know, against deadlines is probably not his bag. Let's turn our attention then to the current Home Secretary and some of the pressures that she faces. It does feel like she's very good at making announcements and then not a lot happening. I mean, the number of times, and we've talked about it, the issue of migrants crossing the Channel. And we've had the announcement that they're going to be sent back to France. They're going to be pushed back by the Royal Navy. They're going to be sent to the Ascension Islands to be processed. They're going to be put on ferries, oil rigs. It's TikTok's fault, all of this stuff. And yet the numbers keep going up. Is that a danger that she's very good at making eye-catching announcements that appeal to, frankly, the right-wing press, but without delivering on the results?
Well, I think it's always a challenge for any cabinet minister, because there's always a gap between when you say you're going to do something and when the results of that policy start to come through, and it's quite easy to look like you're just talking about it and not doing it. In this particular case, you know, the channel crossings are it's very complicated. Yeah. You know, when we talk about border control or when we talk about the immigration system, quite often people talk as though, oh, you just turn off the tap or you turn it back on again. And, you know, in the immigration system overall, it's a really complicated international labour market with, you know, millions of people trying to move around the world, hundreds of different immigration rules you need to change. With the border crossings, you know, a lot of this stuff actually relates to what's going on in completely different parts of the world. Actually, one thing we don't ever talk about is Libya used to basically be Europe's forward border, and we smashed up the Libyan state.
Yeah.
And actually, a lot of these problems have followed from those decisions. And you've got to try to work out what it is that's drawing people to the country and address those things, I think. I mean, my personal view is, in the end, you have to process asylum claims offshore. And you have to say, if you do get to Britain and claim asylum in Britain in this way, you're actually not necessarily going to stay in Britain. You're going to go somewhere else, you'll be processed, and sure, if you're worthy of asylum in the end, then you come. But the big draw really is being able to get to the country and then just, you know, claim asylum straight away, maybe work illegally. We've got a very open economy, and you know, we're not going to change our economic model overnight just to sort of fix this particular problem. Yeah. That would be the tail wagging the dog. So you've got to work out.
Is the mistake then chasing the headlines rather than, you know, it is a very complicated issue, but simplifying it with we're going to send in the gunboats or whatever the next headline is that a problem? Chasing headlines like that.
Well, I think if you talk to the people in the Home Office, I think they do have a pretty good idea of what the factors are that's driving the problem. And if you read between the lines of what's in the latest immigration bill, and I imagine if you read between the lines of what Priti will say in her speech today, then I think, you know, I think they understand that, you know, what I'm talking about is probably the main way in which you might address this problem. But the issue with that is it's going to take time. You've got to legislate for it. You've got to find partners to do the offshore processing. You've got to set it up. You know, it's not, none of this stuff is going to happen in months.
I'm sort of drifting into talking about immigration. Let's hear from your old boss, in fact, Theresa May, when she was Prime Minister, arguing, as Priti Patel does today, that refugees should stay in the first safe country they reach. Can we hear Theresa May?
We should help ensure that refugees claim asylum in the first safe country they reach, and embed this as a principle. The current trend of onward movement benefits criminal gangs, endangers people, and reduces the prospects of refugees ever returning home to rebuild their countries. So we must do far more to support the first safe countries themselves, assisting the refugees and host communities, an approach that is starting to work in Jordan, Lebanon, Turkey.
That was 5 years ago, she was saying that. We're still having the same conversation.
Well, we are, but actually, I think the country has sort of been inching towards the right kind of policy, and actually what she's talking about there in relation to the Syria crisis actually did really help to stem the flow of refugees to Britain. So what the government did was give a lot of support to the neighbouring countries. The percentage of the population living in Lebanon and Jordan who were refugees from Syria was extraordinarily high. I don't remember the numbers, but it was very high. And we gave a lot of support to those countries to help people in the region, and we created a specific scheme to help the most vulnerable Syrians who really needed help that you could only really get in a country like Britain, and brought those people to Britain rather than encouraging or taking a slightly weak approach to allowing the people who undertake the illegal journeys, who are disproportionately young, male, often better off, certainly fitter and healthier, so that we were helping the most vulnerable and we were supporting a much greater number of people in the region. And I think you can see similar principles applying to what the government's been trying to do with Afghanistan.
Do you rate Priti Patel as a Home Secretary?
Yeah, she's good.
You think is she up to the job of actually fixing things rather than just finding headlines?
Of course she is. I mean, it's not easy.
Yeah.
And a place like the Home Office is never fixed. you know, there's politics, and the challenges of politics, you know, change all the time. If you if you think you've cracked the immigration system, then it's probably time to take a cold shower because international smuggling gangs adapt. People spot loopholes in your rules that need to be tightened. You know, economic demands change. People people get drawn into different visa routes. You've got to be sort of constantly vigilant to make sure you've got control. And so I think I said this to a Secretary of State in a different department quite recently. Pretty much every Secretary of State is criticised all the way through their tenure, and then sometimes we look back at some of them and say they were quite good. and you know, it's a hard job, but she's doing it.
Obviously, one of the big issues that she's had to grapple with in the last week or so is the Met Police and the fallout of from the Sarah Everard case. What's your assessment on if Theresa May had still been in the Home Office, you'd still been in the Home Office, would you have kept Cressida Dick in that job?
Personally, I wouldn't, but I don't think that is the only solution to the problem. I mean, I think the Met top team needs to change in its entirety. We need a completely new culture. I think the police have been reformed quite a lot over the last 10 years. Some of it's worked, some of it hasn't. With the Met in particular, I think there's a big culture problem that needs to be investigated. I mean, sure, in other forces, I think there's a bigger problem in the Met. There's plenty of things that can be done to tighten up in terms of, you know, stopping police officers from retiring or resigning when they're still under investigation for misconduct and that kind of thing. But actually, I think the big problem for London is that the Met, every other police force in the country is accountable to a police and crime commissioner or a mayor. And the Met has London responsibilities, policing London, for which it's accountable to the mayor. But it also has national responsibilities like counter-terrorism, protection of public figures and that kind of thing, for which it's accountable to the Home Secretary. And the complicated accountability arrangements, I think, allow...
It's sort of not accountable to anybody.
Yeah, I think it... I mean, it provides a temptation to the Home Office to intervene and interfere, which I don't think is ever a good thing. And it allows the mayor to sort of say, well, I'm not really in charge, when actually, legally, he is for the policing of London. So I think one of the things you could do is take those national commands out of the Met, make the Met purely a London local
force. Just
a
London police force, yeah.
And give those national commands to the National Crime Agency.
Well, have you been surprised? I mean, I think lots of people, reading about the Sarah Everard case, reading about how, you know, Wayne Cousins was known as the rapist, the so-called banter, the misogynistic stuff being shared in WhatsApp groups and all that sort of thing. Has that surprised you, or is it your time dealing with the Met, does that entirely fit your perception of the culture?
Yeah, very sadly, I think it's a part of police culture which needs to change. We did plenty of things, I think, in the Home Office in terms of reforming the Police Federation, introducing specific criminal offences for certain things to do with police conduct. We made the Inspectorate of Constabulary much stronger, much more independent of the cops. But, you know, much more needs to be done. And I think there's a case for some kind of inquiry into police culture, whether that's by HMIC or whether it's something separate. Sorry, HMIC is the inspectorate.
Yeah.
And, you know, this isn't an isolated case. You see stories all the time of police officers who have either disrespected victims. There's a terrible story of police officers taking selfies with the dead bodies of murder victims quite recently, and police officers who take advantage of vulnerable victims of crime and enter into sexual relationships with them. This is not acceptable stuff, and it's not enough to say, oh, he's a bad apple, or there's one or two bad apples. There is a wider systemic problem with the culture.
One of the things that happened in your time at the Home Office was this idea of sort of bringing in some of them outside the UK, sort of Bill Batten style commissioner to sort of shake things up. And that was blocked at the time by Theresa May.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
Do you think that was a mistake? Does it need someone to come completely outside the system and say, enough is enough, this can't go on?
Well, she didn't want to hire Bill Brassen, partly because of the national responsibilities of the Met, so because of counter-terrorism. Because of its counter-terrorism responsibilities, it's quite difficult to have a foreign national come in.
He's also from New York.
Because of the sensitivities of the job. I suspect, actually, you know, that was surmountable. but I think she didn't want to make that hire, I think mainly for that reason. And she appointed Bernard Hogan Howe, who at Merseyside had been a really, like, tough, in-your-face, sort of, you know, intimidating criminals, like a really good police leader, and I think there was a good sort of reason and rationality behind that decision. We actually changed the law to allow foreign nationals from, I can't remember if we made it specific about common law jurisdictions, but foreign police chiefs to be able to come in and become chief constables in this country. And I mean, I think there is a problem with a dearth of talent at the top ranks of the police. So we need to open it up in some way, whether it's about getting foreigners to come in or whether it's about having more forms of direct entry where people from the outside can enter into leadership positions at senior ranks.
Because I suppose if you keep removing someone at the top, you're just promoting people out of the same culture.
Exactly. And so we've got 43 forces in England and Wales, and so we've got 43 chief constables to choose from.
Yeah, and that's what, I suppose it goes back to the point, if you separate the two out, then it makes it more palatable. It's Matt Trolley speaking to Nick Timothy, former advisor to Theresa May at the Home Office and at Number 10. We'll talk about politics more generally next here on Times Radio.
On digital radio, on the web, and via the Times Radio app. Matt Chorley on Times Radio.
Yeah, Matt Chorley live from the Conservative Party conference in Manchester, still joined by Nick Timothy, former special advisor to Theresa May at the Home Office, and then later at Number 10. Nick, I want to talk to you about Erdington conservatism. In the run-up to the 20... I think I wrote quite a long piece of the Times about it back in 2017, ahead of the 2017 election. And it was a sort of... It was your idea of sort of conservatives appealing to working class blue collar workers. It was a shift away from the sort of Notting Hillness of David Cameron's sort of liberal conservatism. Explain what the pitch was, first of all, for Erdington conservatism, and was it just an early? Did you do all the heavy lifting for Boris Johnson, essentially, but smashing through the red wall?
Well, I think there's a kind of commonality in the way he's approached the job to what we tried to do, but you know, it didn't work for us. Yeah. And, you know, he won the red wall, so well done him. I mean, the original position was because we'd had these debates about the way the Tory party needed to change in the past, and the way David Cameron had changed the party was kind of dismissed as Soho modernization, as liberal, very acceptable to people of a certain class, very acceptable at dinner parties in London and that kind of thing, but quite far removed from the interests and values of a lot of people out in the rest of the country. And then there was another argument that the Tory party needed to follow so-called Easter House modernization, which was named after the estate in Glasgow, which was all about how the party had to focus on the very poorest and had an almost like 19th century evangelical feel to it. and I said, well, no, there needs to be there's a third approach, which actually where the party needs to put itself at the service of working class families, people who have a job but don't have an especially high income. They might own their own home, but they have insecurity about whether they can certainly pay the mortgage. They don't have much by way of savings and that kind of thing. And if we were to do that, then we needed to change and be much more open-minded about the role of the state and the good that government can do, as to borrow a phrase I once wrote, and also to empower communities much more. So instead of thinking about politics in terms of it being about the market versus the state, you should think about the market, the state, and community as a kind of partnership of three, where no one of those things can survive without the other two.
So why didn't it work? Was it because your diagnosis of the problem seems very similar? The solution, the people you wanted to reach was the same. Is Boris Johnson a better politician than Theresa May? It sort of finishing the job.
Well, he's certainly a much better campaigner in elections, and that's one of the reasons. I mean, like, we could devote the whole day of broadcasting to talking about why it didn't work. In the first year that she had in Downing Street, it was incredibly popular. People heard it, they liked it, but. She then wasn't able to follow through for a variety of reasons. I was only there for that year. I played my part in screwing up the 2017 election, which is why I wasn't there after that. But the election going wrong, and for all the reasons that went wrong, the fact that the government was consumed with the Brexit wars, And if, you know, if there'd been a much bigger majority, then maybe she'd have been able to do both Brexit and some of the reforms she was talking about. But I think also, ultimately, she wasn't quite prepared to go as far as she needed to go. So I remember in the year in Downing Street between the Brexit referendum and the 17 election, talking, you know, on several occasions about, you know, how can we change fiscal policy? Because we're basically in this straitjacket of economic policies that have been set by George Osborne. And actually, you know, the economics of austerity, certainly by that time, I think, weren't right. The politics of austerity were pretty terrible as well.
Yeah.
And I couldn't, I tried and failed to sort of get her off that fiscal policy we inherited. We did change it a little bit to allow for a bit more investment spending, but that was about it. So, you know, Boris went the whole hog. He's a great campaigner. He won the election. He did Brexit, and he's quite open-minded about spending money. He's changed fiscal policy. Obviously, events have also interrupted, you know, his premiership with COVID. And I think the interesting thing now is, you know, does he continue and see through the logic of his positions? Because if we now enter into a period of returned austerity because of the stock of debt we've built up over the last year or two, then I think the mission falls.
You obviously touched on the fact you were there in number 10 for a year. You left after the 2017 election, along with Fiona Hill. You were joint chief of staff. And at that time, there were lots of stories about the way that you'd both treated people in and around number 10. Looking back now, what is it now, we're 4 years on, do you look back now and think, do you have any regrets about that? Do you wish it played out differently?
Well, I mean, I have regrets about the way the election worked. Some of which was, you know, frankly, directly, you know, my responsibility, and I take responsibility for that. Some of which was some other stuff, where, you know, it was down to decisions made by other people, but I was in the room and I could have said, "Why are we doing this? like, this isn't actually consistent with the strategy we'd set in the year before the election." Yeah. And I didn't do it.
Yeah.
And I will sort of always wonder about that. In terms of treating people well or badly, I just, like, to be perfectly honest, those stories just aren't true. I mean, a lot gets said. You know, I became a bit of a pantomime villain because of my role in the election, and then it becomes open season, and people say all sorts of things about you. You know, frankly, people were a bit angry with me because of the manifesto, and it became open season. But almost all my former colleagues from Number 10 are here, and I've been drinking with them and seeing them, and they come round for dinner and we're mates.
What about Theresa May? She seems to be enjoying needling Boris Johnson from the back benches. Is that your impression as well?
Yeah, she kind of resembles Ted Heath in a skirt these days.
is that a good strategy for her, do you think?
I would advise against it, to be honest. I think.
Are you still in touch? Do you speak?
No, we don't really talk anymore, but I think...
That must be weird. You worked so closely with her. You basically made her prime minister.
It's a bit weird. It was a bit weird. It's not really weird anymore.
You don't spend all your time thinking.
Yeah, it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
And I just think it is quite tricky being a former prime minister in Parliament. And I think it's a good thing that she stayed. It's
I
good
totally
for
agree
Parliament.
With you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Parliament would be so much better if it had more former chancellors, former foreign secretaries, former prime ministers.
Yeah, I think so. I think so. And, you know, there's just not very much experience on those backbenches. And it is good to have somebody say, you know, well, we tried this and the reason it didn't work was the following.
We did this, we did it then, we did it then, we did it then. It doesn't work. Don't
but
do
I
it.
I think she needs to be a bit more selective in her criticisms. She doesn't want to just look like she's a bit bitter.
Yeah.
And she could be a bit more constructive in the way she says things.
And are you enjoying conference? Is it a thing that you presume you enjoy it more when you haven't got to write the speech and
this year is a very different experience for me because it's actually my first year back since the 2016 election, 2016 conference, and it's quite easy. You just see friends, have a few drinks, do a few interviews.
Pop on the radio.
It's not nearly as hard work as actually doing it.
That's all we've got time for on this episode of the Red Box Podcast. Don't forget you can listen to me live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1 on Times Radio. And we bring you the best bits here on the podcast. And if you're feeling particularly nice, why not wait and review us wherever you get your podcasts from?
If there's one thing that my family and friends know me for, it's being an amazing gift giver. I owe it all to Celebrations Passport from 1-800-Flowers.com, my one-stop shopping site that has amazing gifts for every occasion. With Celebrations Passport, I get free shipping on thousands of amazing gifts. And the more gifts I give, the more perks and rewards I earn. To learn more and take your gift giving to the next level, visit 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST. That's 1-800-Flowers.com/ACAST.
Do you ever feel like your brain is on overdrive and your mind is constantly racing? The plans, worries, and to-do lists are never ending. Calm can help your mind take a break from the noise by softening anxiety symptoms in the moment and helping you cope with day-to-day stressors. Calm is the number one app for sleep and meditation, giving you the power to calm your mind and change your life. Their meditations range to fit your needs each day, from anxiety and stress, relaxation and focus, to building habits and taking care of your physical well-being. They even have expert-led talks on topics such as tips for overcoming stress and anxiety, handling grief, improving self-esteem, caring for relationships, and more. For listeners of the show, Calm is offering an exclusive offer of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/stressless. Go to calm.com/stressless for 40% off unlimited access to Calm's entire library. That's calm.com/stressless.